So turn with me again, please, to Matthew chapter 26. And we're looking this morning at verses 30 to 44. So this passage records pretty much Jesus' last three movements. From this point on, he will go places, but not by his own choice. Chapter 26, verse 57, those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas. Chapter 27, verse 2, and they bound him and led him away. Chapter 27, verse 27, the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the governor's headquarters. Chapter 27, verse 31, they led him away to crucify him. His movements are soon going to be dictated by others, but here at this very late hour on the Thursday evening, or perhaps even this very early hour on the Friday morning, he goes where he pleases. And those last three movements take him to the Mount of Olives, verse 30, and then more specifically to one part of the Mount of Olives, to a place called Gethsemane, verse 36. And he's there in Gethsemane for some time, at least an hour, verse 40 indicates, perhaps quite a bit longer than an hour. What's he doing? What's he up to in Gethsemane? Well, we could answer that in different ways, but I think the most comprehensive answer is this: he's watching. He's watching. We often isolate verse 41 from its context, and so watch and pray just becomes this duty which Jesus imposes on his people. But in the context, it's not so much a duty which Jesus imposes as a call to share with him in what he's doing here. Verse 38, remain here and watch with me, he says. Verse 40, could you not watch with me 1 hour? We think of Jesus in Gethsemane commanding others to watch, and that's true, but primarily in Gethsemane, Jesus is himself watching. And so, as I say, that's really the best answer to this question. What is Jesus doing in this out-of-the-way place for this considerable chunk of time? He is watching. I remember seeing a newspaper article a while ago about St. Helens in Merseyside. And in one part of St. Helens, apparently there were so many burglaries taking place that the local residents had set up their own scheme whereby they took it in turns to stay up at night watching. They knew there was danger lurking on those streets. There were bad men around, and so they watched in order not to fall prey to that danger. And in that sense, Jesus is watching in Gethsemane. He knows that on this momentous night, there's danger lurking. And if we have read on from where our passage ends this morning, you might say, ah, yes, Dan, I see what you mean by that. There's a gang of men armed with swords and clubs making their way to this place. There is indeed danger lurking. He's right to watch. But that's not what I mean. The danger lurking this night isn't a gang of men. It's temptation. That's the word he uses in verse 41. It's temptation that necessitates this watching. What kind of temptation? Well, the temptation to escape that gang of men. The temptation to escape the death that he has just talked about over that Passover meal. The temptation to run away from all that lies before him over the coming hours. That's the danger of which Jesus is so conscious here. That's the danger to which he must not fall prey. And so he watches like an anxious homeowner in St. Helens. He watches. And this morning then, I just want to highlight two main things, and we'll spend longer on the first. First of all, this watching is serious. This watching is serious. It really is a danger that Jesus this night might turn on his heel and run, that he might suddenly panic and make a desperate bid to escape. Why? Why is that a danger? Why can't he just calmly go through what lies before him here? Well, here are three reasons why. First, because Jesus' death is exceptional. Because Jesus' death is exceptional. It's not the mere prospect of pain that might provoke Jesus to run. It's not the prospect of struggling for breath. It's not the prospect of bodily organs shutting down. It's not the prospect of exiting mortal life. It's not the prospect of rigor mortis or anything like that that might push Jesus to take evasive action. Rather, his death is going to involve more, way more. And in that more, in that extra exceptional dimension to Jesus' death, there resides the real incentive for him to escape. He describes his death in this passage in two terrible ways. First, he talks in verse 31 about being struck. In itself, that might not sound too bad. But look at what he says. He quotes in verse 31 from the Old Testament prophecy of Zechariah, "I will strike the shepherd." Now the shepherd there, then, Jesus is identifying with himself. He's the shepherd. Who is the one doing the striking? Who is the I there? Well, when you go back to Zechariah 13, you discover that it's Yahweh. It's God. In other words, there's this divine involvement in Jesus' death. Now, of course, there's divine involvement in everything. All events flow from God's sovereign will. We all know that, but this is different. This is very direct divine involvement. It isn't simply that God lies behind Jesus' death or that God ordains Jesus' death. Rather, in Jesus' death, God acts against Jesus. God strikes him. Think about that. What's it like to be struck by someone? Well, it all depends on the size and power of the one doing the striking. If you're bending down, giving some attention to little Seth, who's with us, I think, this morning, and he suddenly flaps his arm and you're struck in the face by him, that's unlikely to cause you all that much damage. If, on the other hand, the Newcastle Falcons rugby team are on a night out in Newcastle and one of them, under the influence of alcohol, takes a dislike to you as you walk past him in the street, pulls back an arm bulging with muscles and strikes you in the face, that is going to damage you pretty badly. And here then, we're not talking about a rugby player. We're talking about God, the immeasurable, omnipotent God. Remember the psalmist's exclamation about God, "You have a mighty arm. Strong is your hand. High your right hand." Psalm 89, verse 13. Indeed, Isaiah pictures God's hand as being so gigantic that all the world's oceans put together are just a little splash in the hollow of that hand. Isaiah 40, verse 12. In Psalm 8, verse 3, "The heavens are the work of God's fingers." You think of a pianist struggling to stretch her fingers across the keys of an instrument that's just the size of that one there. And God then can stretch his colossal fingers across the galaxies, across trillions and trillions of miles of space, and to be struck then, to be struck with all the weight of those fingers on that hand propelled by that arm is terrifying. It doesn't bear thinking about. And I know when we talk about Jesus being struck by God like that, we're using imagery. I know God doesn't literally reach down an arm from heaven and land a physical blow. But the imagery there in verse 31 isn't chosen for no reason. God may not land a physical blow, but clearly he does something to Jesus for which that is an appropriate picture, something on that level of devastating force and horrific intensity. The other description Jesus gives of his death in the passage is in verse 39. He describes it as a cup that he has to drink. It's another Old Testament allusion, although this time not to one passage in particular. It's just an Old Testament motif that God, on account of idolatry and greed and sexual perversion and all kinds of evils, gives to the nations, now perhaps to Assyria, now perhaps to the Babylonians, a cup brimming with his wrath, and they have to gulp it down. And Jesus then, in his death, must press to his lips and gulp from that same cup. And for the same reason, on account of idolatry and greed and sexual perversion and all kinds of evils, only in his case, not evils that he himself has actually practiced. Others have practiced them. Others are the perpetrators. Others have done the deeds. He faces the consequences. His trembling hand takes hold of the cup, and down his throat and into his stomach flows the burning wrath of a holy, sin-hating God. And so you can see then, I hope, Jesus' death is exceptional. Dying in the normal sense is not the issue here. This death involves being pummeled by God's almighty arm. This death involves choking on the fiery wine of God's wrath. This death is uniquely horrendous. No wonder the danger of Jesus running away from it is real. But here's another reason. Yes, because Jesus' death is exceptional. Secondly, because Jesus' temptation is satanic. Because Jesus' temptation is satanic. Sometimes a course of action is just inherently tempting. And for Jesus, running away from this death is inherently tempting. How could it not be in the light of what we've just said about his death? There would be something perverse and sinister about Jesus if he didn't want to escape that divine striking, that divine cup. Running away is just inherently tempting, but a course of action that's already inherently tempting can then become a whole lot harder to resist if Satan, the tempter, as the Bible calls him, gets involved. When he adds his pressure to a suggestion that's pretty alluring as it is, that's when things really hot up. And I put it to you, that is happening here. The evil one is involved. Fleeing from that death that awaits him isn't just inherently tempting. Jesus' temptation is also satanic. Now, I can't point you to a verse here where Satan's name is mentioned. I admit that. But of course, this passage doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's part of this gospel that we've been working our way through now for many, many months. And in this gospel, there have been moments when unambiguously Satan was trying to steer Jesus away from dying this death. The most recent was chapter 16, verse 22, where you remember Peter protested against the prospect of the cross. "Far be it from you, Lord," he said. But Jesus saw through that protest. He saw what was really happening, or rather, he saw who was really speaking. "Get behind me, Satan," Jesus replied. Satan, through Peter, was tempting Jesus to abandon this whole death business. Another earlier moment in the gospel was that famous wilderness scene in chapter 4. And there, Satan's assaults on Jesus were fairly elaborate and fairly diverse, but basically his overarching agenda there was singular. It was to tempt Jesus onto some kind of path that was fundamentally incompatible with dying on a cross. And in the light of those earlier moments then, it's almost as if here in this moment, in chapter 26, Matthew doesn't even need to mention Satan's involvement. It just goes without saying. If Jesus, long before his death, on more than one occasion, faced satanic temptation to avoid that death, then certainly, now it's only hours away, he faces satanic temptation to avoid it. Matthew expects us to make that obvious inference. He may also include a subtle little hint, actually, for those who have the eyes to see it. It's interesting that there in the wilderness, the satanic temptation comes at Jesus in three separate waves. And it may not be coincidence then that here Jesus prays three times. Perhaps because again he's facing three waves of temptation, because the same tempter from that earlier scene is involved again, adopting a similar approach to before. And so this is a second reason then why the danger of Jesus attempting an escape is real. The exceptional nature of the death Jesus has to die provides sufficient incentive to start with. But on top of that, I'm saying Satan is pushing Jesus towards such an escape. He's using all his hellish craft to make escape seem reasonable and appropriate and honorable to Jesus. Jesus is being leaned on here. He's being pressured. The architect of Adam's capitulation and other capitulations besides is working now his devilish magic on Jesus. But then one more reason that this danger is real. Yes, because Jesus' death is exceptional, and yes, because Jesus' temptation is satanic. But thirdly, because Jesus' constitution is frail. Because Jesus' constitution is frail. In verse 41 then, Jesus says, "Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." So clearly then for the disciples, watching is vital because of this fleshly weakness that Jesus mentions here. But remember what we've already seen this morning, that their watching is merely a sharing in his watching. So presumably we can infer then that it's true for him too, that watching is vital because of this fleshly weakness that he mentions in the second half of verse 41. Now, that might make us feel a little bit uncomfortable. Applying those words, "the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," to Jesus. But if it does make us feel uncomfortable, I think that's probably due to a certain confusion. We're perhaps thinking in terms of Paul's frequent use of the word flesh. Paul frequently uses this word in a moral sense. The flesh is moral badness, the impulse in the human heart to sin and defy God. And of course, the flesh in that sense is absolutely inapplicable to Jesus. In him, there's no moral badness. In him, there's no impulse to sin and defy God. But that's not what this phrase in Matthew 26:41 is about. The flesh here isn't sinfulness, as it so often is in Paul's writings. The flesh here is creatureliness. And this fleshly weakness then that Jesus talks about is what I'm going to call creaturely frailty. And that does apply to the man Jesus Christ. There's actually a very interesting distinction here where I think we've often been guilty of an imbalance. Jesus refers, doesn't he, to a willing spirit. The spirit is willing. And every believer then, due to the new birth, has a willing spirit. Every believer wants to do good and please God. So why often don't we do good and please God? Well, sometimes it's because of the flesh in Paul's sense of the word. It's because of sinful impulses. And the flesh in that sense works by corroding the willing spirit in us. Selfishness and lust and malice attack the willing spirit and poison it and, as it were, eat it up. Sometimes that's what's happening when we don't do good and please God. And I think in our Christian circles we've given a lot of attention to that. But at other times we don't do good and please God because of the flesh in this other sense of the word, because of creaturely frailty. And the flesh in that sense doesn't exactly corrode and poison the willing spirit in us. That's not how it works. Rather, it just blocks the willing spirit and prevents it from coming to fruition. And I don't think we've generally given this phenomenon so much attention. As I say, there's been an imbalance, but that's what Jesus is talking about here with respect to these disciples. He has in mind, I think, their impending desertions and denials that he has foretold in verses 31 to 34. And he's saying then that they want to be loyal to him that night. They really do. They really want to be loyal to Jesus, their master, that night. It's not that they have a lurking defiance in their hearts towards Jesus, or that they get a kick from letting him down and making him suffer. It's not that the flesh, in Paul's sense of the word, has eaten up their willing spirits. No, there's a willing spirit definitely there within them. It's just that it's going to be blocked by the flesh in that other sense, by a creaturely frailty that will be daunted and intimidated and overwhelmed by what loyalty to Jesus entails that night. And let's think of Jesus then. And with him, then, it's a willing spirit, isn't it? It's a willing spirit to obey and please God by dying this sacrificial death. It's that has brought him down from heaven to earth. And it's that willing spirit to obey and please God and die that sacrificial death that has driven him now for more than 30 years. And the flesh, in Paul's sense of the word, isn't an issue for Jesus. His willing spirit isn't going to be corroded by some ugly impulse in him to defy God. He has no such impulses. But his willing spirit could just be blocked. Blocked by the flesh in this other sense, by a creaturely frailty that's daunted and intimidated by what obeying and pleasing God at Calvary involves. I mean, he's pretty daunted and intimidated in verses 37 and 38, isn't he? He's sorrowful. He's troubled. He's very sorrowful, even to death. Strong language. Those are the powerful emotions of a human being stretched almost to breaking point, a human constitution under such strain it is close to unraveling. Clearly, a creaturely frailty is there that has the potential to frustrate the willing spirit that's burning away in his breast and make him throw in the towel and run away from the cross despite that willing spirit. And so that's the third reason that Jesus escaping here is a real danger, because Jesus' constitution is frail. I think it was 3 years ago, Talitha and Fraser and I were at a motor show in Newcastle city centre. I'm not sure whether it still takes place, but for 2 or 3 years in a row at least, there was this free motor show in Grey Street and the surrounding area. And this one then, the three of us attended a performance by a stuntman who was aptly named Paul Swift. And he did this on a side street in the centre of Newcastle, close to the Theatre Royal. And one of the stunts that he did was this. He would get his assistants to parallel park two cars at the side of the street with a gap in between them. So pretend then that this room is the street. There would be one car parked along there where the radiator is, and then another car parked at the further end of the wall, and a gap in between them. And poor Swift would then get into his souped-up Ford Focus and drive very, very fast that way along the streets. And at some point, perhaps about where the Smiths are or Bob is or somewhere like that, at full flight, at full speed, he would perform this handbrake turn and land up in the gap between the two cars facing this way again. And there'd be kind of screeching tires and a cloud of smoke as he did so. And he would then get out of the car to loud applause from the spectators and start walking away. However, he would then hear a voice in the crowd shouting, "Make the gap smaller." And so he would stop and he would repeat those words with an astonished look on his face, as though this were the most ridiculous suggestion he'd ever heard in his life. He would kind of go back and take a long look at the precise dimensions of the gap, and he would look very anxious, and he would scratch his head and chat to his assistants about it. And then, to the delight of the crowd, he would jump back into his Ford Focus, he would get the assistants to move the cars and make the gap smaller, and he would perform the stunt all over again. And he went through this rigmarole several times until the gap was so tight that you and I would struggle to park in it in the normal way without doing a handbrake turn at full speed. But of course, all those shocked facial expressions, all that stuff, anxiously examining the dimensions of the parking space and scratching his head nervously and needing a lot of persuasion from the crowd, it was all an act. He was completely within his comfort zone at every single point. There was never really any possibility of him smashing into one of the other cars. For this professional stuntman, there was no real danger involved. And we can read this passage as though it were like that for Jesus here. As though this watching business were all just an act. Of course he's going to go and die on that cross in a few hours' time. The alternative isn't really a possibility. There's no real danger of things going wrong and the cross being abandoned. His prayers and all the rest of it here, they're just a bit of a Paul Swift-style performance. And I'm saying that's not the case. Gethsemane is a truly dramatic moment which you and I should read of tremblingly. Donald MacLeod says, "For a moment, the whole salvation of the world hangs in the balance, suspended on the free, unconstrained decision of this man." Jesus' death is exceptional. Jesus' temptation is satanic. Jesus' constitution is frail. The danger of him pulling out is great. He must watch, all right. He must watch like no one, no explorer in a lion-infested jungle, no resident on a crime-plagued street in St. Helens, like no one has ever watched before. This watching, I'm saying, is deadly. Deadly serious. So this watching is serious, but then secondly, and much more briefly, this watching is successful. This watching is successful. He doesn't run away. He doesn't throw in the towel. He doesn't escape the gang of men approaching him and the death that lies before him. He watches for that danger. The danger of running away. And through watching, he doesn't fall prey to it. This watching is successful. What form does it take? What does this watching actually look like? Well, the famous phrase there in verse 41 is watch and pray. And I don't think he's distinguishing two separate activities there. Rather, the praying defines the watching. It's watching through prayer. Of course, in that verse, he's instructing his disciples, but I've said all along this morning that their watching is simply a sharing in his watching, and so presumably for him too, the watching takes the form of prayer. And indeed, that's conspicuously what he does in this place called Gethsemane, isn't it? He prays. And it's very interesting, actually. It's not so much that he prays specifically for a deepened resolve to endure the death of the cross. He doesn't actually request that at all, does he? It's rather that as he prays, his resolve to endure the death of the cross simply is deepened. You see that happening, don't you? So the first prayer there in verse 39, it comprises two petitions. Let the cup pass from me. And by the way, there's no shame in praying for things that God doesn't actually choose to give us. That was Jesus' experience here. So let the cup pass from me, that's one petition, and then your will be done. There are two petitions. The second prayer in verse 42, however, comprises only one petition. Your will be done. His resolve has deepened. Which I think reminds us that there's more going on in prayer than simply requests being formally submitted and God either granting or refusing those requests. Beyond the specifics of the actual requests which we make in prayer, God works in us as we pray. So that Jesus emerges from this praying more committed to dying on the cross, even though he hasn't expressly asked to become more committed to dying on the cross. I don't want to miss the opportunity then to make the obvious application to us all this morning. Pray. Pray. Are you conscious of danger present in your Christian life this morning? Is there lurking some perilous temptation that threatens to capsize your Christian discipleship? Well then, watch and pray. That is, watch through praying. Follow both Jesus' instruction in verse 41 and Jesus' example throughout these verses. Because when you pray, you enter a mysterious supernatural realm in which things really happen. And how precisely and well you express your actual petitions is far less important than the mere fact you are engaging with God. Because through that mere engagement with God, you will emerge better equipped to withstand and overcome the temptation you're facing. I know it sounds too simple, doesn't it? I know you can't help thinking that there must be more involved. Some fancy technique that you can only pick up by reading the latest best-selling Christian book from Amazon. I'm saying that's not so. The great necessity in the face of dangerous temptation, Jesus says and exemplifies, is prayer. Is prayer. That's how successful watching occurs. Not through going about with a torch, literally looking for something, the way you might watch for some normal danger. Praying, praying, praying. That's how you watch in the face of this danger, the danger of temptation. Remember Hebrews 4:15, the writer there says the same thing, doesn't he? That you approach the throne of grace, at the right hand of which is a high priest who knows all about temptation himself from nights such as this one. Prayer. It's through prayer that we watch in the face of dangerous, dangerous temptation. And I suppose I could really go to town on this. And I could close then by emphasizing very somberly the disciples here in our passage. The disciples who didn't watch through prayer. They slept, and who were capsized this night. what Jesus predicts there in verses 31 to 34. Verse 31, the disciples falling away this night, being scattered. Verse 34, Peter denying him three times. That happens not simply as some bare, uncaused fulfillment of Jesus predicting it. It happens for a reason. It happens because the disciples don't follow Jesus' instruction and watch and pray. They're capsized that night because they don't do this. They don't watch the way Jesus watched. And as I say then, we could go to town on that. And I could rant at you for a few minutes. Don't be like these men. But I want to close rather on the note of verse 32, where Jesus says, having just predicted that the sheep of the flock will be scattered, they will fall away, he says, after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. The verb go before you, it's a verb that's used of a shepherd going before the sheep. And so I think Jesus is probably continuing the shepherding imagery from the Zechariah quotation. And he's saying then that in a few days' time, he is going to shepherd these men. He's going to lead these men. They're going to be his sheep following him. And it's such a striking juxtaposition, isn't it? He's talking before verse 32 and after verse 32 about how they're going to desert and deny him that night. And in verse 32, he's saying soon he's going to have them as his sheep in his flock and he's going to be leading them. And you think, well, this must be wrong. Surely this night is going to finish them. Surely this night is going to leave them languishing on the garbage heap of discipleship failures. Surely there's no future for these men beyond falling away from Jesus this night, beyond denying Jesus three times this night. Surely verse 32 must be a glitch, it must be a typo, there must be something wrong there. But no, verse 32 isn't a glitch or a typo. Because you see, this is the thing. At the end of the day, for these men, everything depends not on their success at watching through prayer, but on Jesus' success at watching through prayer. Not on their success at avoiding temptation, but on his success at avoiding temptation. And it's exactly the same for us. And perhaps, I said a moment ago, perhaps you're conscious of some dangerous temptation lurking in your life just now. Perhaps it's not that. Perhaps you're conscious this morning of dangerous temptation this past week that did capsize you and that did entangle you and that did pull you down. And perhaps you're sitting here this morning wondering, is there a way back for me? Have I blown it? Is there a way back? And I'm saying there is a way back. Just as there was for these men. Because at the end of the day, everything depends not on you being successful, but on him being successful. If he had fallen this night, if he had gone to sleep and neglected the watching through prayer, and if he had then woken up, seen the men approaching and ran for it and never come back and never died on the cross, then there would be no way back for us. But he succeeded. He succeeded. He succeeded. And that's where our salvation resides this morning. Not in our successes, in his success. And in fact, because I don't want to downplay the importance of us watching and praying, but in fact, it's the more we feel the liberating wonder of his success being the ground of our salvation that we will be animated to watch and pray and be more successful in our own lives. So rejoice in his success this morning. Rejoice in his success. Don't stew and stew and stew over failures in your own life, but bask in the Saviour who didn't fail that Thursday night or Friday morning, who went to the cross, who watched and prayed and triumphed. We're not going to close with a hymn, but if we were, it might be this one. 596, you can look at it yourselves later today. This first verse, Horatius Bonar. Thy works, not mine, O Christ, speak gladness to this heart. They tell me all is done, they bid my fear depart. To whom save thee who canst alone for sin atone, Lord, shall I flee? Thy works, not mine, his success, not ours. Reset your gaze on that this morning. Amen.